You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. Much of western Kentucky has been upgraded to an exceptional drought status. This means crops are struggling, sport practices are being canceled, and bottled water sales are up. The effects reach past the shoreline, though, to our waterways. Regional lakes and rivers are well below normal levels. Rose Kristen Presson explores how a nearly 10-foot drop in the Ohio River has affected traffic for both the Four Rivers region and all of the southeastern United States.
There's one boat at Paducah's riverfront today, the motor vessel J.W. Heron. Fresh crew members climb aboard carrying backpacks from a nearby pickup truck onto the barge. The ship's hauling gravel to New Orleans, not as much as usual though. Captain Curtis Ellman says they had to lighten their load because of low river levels.
Here below lock 52 and in 53, there's a lot of boats that can't go through the lockage because the water's too low. The boats draft too much, barges draft too much, barges being tied up.
Draft is how low the boat sits in the water. Even with the lighter load and smaller draft, Ellman says he and his crew have still had some difficulties.
Well, we've run aground a couple times with low water, yeah.
What do you do?
Wiggle off of it.
Have you had water this low before in your experience?
Not in my experience, no.
Okay. How long have you been doing this?
Since 93.
The major rivers in the southeastern U.S. are regulated with locks and dams. The Army Corps of Engineers tries to maintain at least a 9-foot depth for barge navigation on the Ohio River in this area. So, when the water drops, companies like Ellman's Four Rivers Towing ride a fine line between navigation troubles and sacrificing profits. Paducah McCracken County Riverport Executive Director Ken Cantor explains.
A barge at 9 feet will be carrying approximately 1,500 tons, and if they lighten it to 8 feet or 7.5 feet, you're looking at a 300 or 400 ton reduction in the cargo.
That's where Cantor and the Riverport come in. Boats from Mobile to Minneapolis pass through Paducah's riverfront, and sometimes they need to lighten or even completely unload their cargo. Paducah's at a key location for these boats, and since this area is renowned for having varying weather, remember last year's floods, Cantor says Paducah's riverport is able to handle just about any river conditions.
Whether it be ice on the upper Mississippi, lock problems on the Ohio River, low water, high water sometimes, is where we get the benefit of our location, that we get calls from people who need barges unloaded.
Say a ship departs from Nebraska, where they're getting some rain right now. That ship holds enough cargo that it has a 9-foot draft. As it travels down the Missouri and the Mississippi, and it gets to the Ohio River at Paducah, they find shallower waters. The channels here are only 9 feet deep, and the boat is dragging on the bottom of the river. So they stop at Paducah's riverport and unload, a few hundred tons of cargo. Now the boat only has a 7-foot draft. It can continue down the river, but where did all that cargo go? The riverport leases out over 100,000 square feet of warehouse space to store such cargo. At least, Cantor says, until another barge can come pick it up.
We have not seen a decline in our normal business patterns. If anything, we've seen an increase in the inquiries for people that wanted us to help them out.
Barge companies have a good idea if they'll need that help when they check the forecast sent out by the National Weather Service. Hydrometeorological technician Robin Smith says he covers an area from about St. Louis to Memphis to Tell City and Vincennes in southern Indiana.
But most generally, everything's running about half of what it should be.
Half the normal depth. Smith says rain in northern states should make its way down here in a few days, but if the water were to drop much lower, he says, commercial traffic will take a major hit.
You know, if we keep having these situations, we'll have to just shut barge traffic at different locations along all the rivers.
But for now, barges of sand and fertilizer and petroleum and steel and wire and rubber and gravel are still slowly making their way along the southeast rivers. The new crew members boarding Curtis Ellman's vessel will eventually see the New Orleans shipyards. For WKMS News, I'm Rose Kristen Presson.
Now that the drought plaguing our region has been upgraded in severity to the highest level on the scale, U.S. agriculture officials are looking at ways to help out affected farmers. USDA Deputy Undersecretary Karis Gutter toured western Kentucky last week to meet with these farmers, and he took some time to tell Shelley Baskin what he learned.
So, Secretary Gutter, what exactly has spurred your trip out to our region this week?
Well, late last week, the Secretary called on a number of the top officials at USDA to get out into the country to put eyes on the actual damage that's occurred as a result of the drought conditions throughout the Midwest. And so That's one of the primary reasons I'm out here today. I began my travels and trip in Tennessee, in Dyersburg, Tennessee. We made our way into Kentucky, into the Paducah area. But for the most part, we're examining the drought-stricken corn and soybean and other crops that exist across the Midwest.
I understand that a lot of those crops that you're looking at are in pretty bad shape. What all can the USDA do to help the people growing those crops?
Some of the resources that we've got in our toolkit are crop insurance. Crop insurance will be a major, major help to a lot of the producers that have recently been hurt by the damage that's here. For the most part, a majority, an overwhelming majority of the producers I've met with participate in the program in one form or another, and we really anticipate it holding up really well to the damage that we've seen. In addition to crop insurance, we've got FSA's programs, the NAP program, the non-insured assistance program, helping a lot of fruit and vegetable growers throughout the region. But for the most part, livestock is really an area of concern for us. Some of the major disaster assistance programs that help support that industry have since expired with the 2008 Farm Bill. And so what we'll need from USDA's perspective is for Congress to act in order for us to have a disaster assistance set of programs that can adequately respond to the damage that we're witnessing out here today.
Do you think that what you've seen out here will be something you can take back to Congress to maybe illustrate how those disaster relief programs are really needed?
Without question. One of the things that we've been able to do is talk face-to-face with producers who really are in need of help. We've talked to producers who've been livestock producers, producers who grow corn and grain and hay and a lot of pasture farms. Those are the major, major areas of concern. And so in order for us to have the kinds of programs, we've got five programs in particular, the livestock forage program that helps with the forage, the livestock indemnity program that helps with deaths of livestock as a result of extreme heat. We've got the emergency livestock assistance program, which will help. We've got the tree assistance program that helps with nurseries. Those key core programs are the right kinds of programs that can help, given the types of disasters that have been witnessed and experienced out here in these parts of the country.
And what about the economy and various budget issues the country is facing? Is that going to make it harder to convince Congress to authorize the assistance programs?
As I understand the way that the Farm Bill conversations making its way through Congress right now is that it does begin to contribute towards reducing the deficit and the debt. And so that should not be a major challenge. But in that 2012 Farm Bill conversation is the reauthorization of the disaster assistance programs that expired back in September of 2011. And so we need for Congress to act swiftly so that the timely assistance that's being asked for is actually delivered in a timely way.
So let's say that you're only able to see one of the programs make it through to help the country's producers. Which one do you think would be the most important?
Well, all of our safety net programs work in concert with one another. So we absolutely need crop insurance, but there are things that crop insurance don't cover, and so that's where you need the FSA suite of programs, and you need that NRCS suite of programs to help support those others. So it's a family unit of programs that all are necessary to cover all of the damages that have occurred throughout the region. So I couldn't pick one over the other because in spite of all of the issues that have happened throughout this region, our job at USDA is to help all producers of all stripes and all walks of life, and we want to do just that. We've done a whole lot to help, but we're just going to need that extra push from Congress to have the authorities and have the resources to help the folks who have come into our offices. If I had one request, though, what we're going to need now more than ever are producers to continue to keep good records and receipts so that when they do come in, they can begin to show and share with us the extent of the damages that they've had. If they've got pictures, those tend to work. But for the most part, if they don't have any of that, just contacting our offices is the very first best step. If and when you have losses, contact your FSA county office, contact your crop insurance agent, and let them know what's going on, and they can point you in the right direction and let you know everything that it is that you need.
Karis Gutter is the USDA's Deputy Undersecretary for Farm and Foreign Agricultural Services. He spent the week talking to farmers in our region about USDA drought relief programs. Secretary Gutter, thank you for talking with me.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
The annual Fancy Farm Picnic is this upcoming weekend at St. Jerome's Catholic Parish in Graves County. It's the unofficial kickoff of the political season with fiery stump speeches from candidates seeking statewide office. Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Kenny Colston will be on hand for this year's picnic. He joins me to talk about his expectations and other things politics in the Commonwealth. Kenny, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Fancy Farm is usually a feeding frenzy for journalists, but you've reported this past week that it will be a little less exciting this year.
Yeah, that's right. The governor is not going to be in attendance. He's at an economic development meetings in Europe with Germany and France. The lieutenant governor says he has a family issue or a family event. U.S. Senator Rand Paul says he's going to stay home with his family. So really the marquee name is U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell, and that's probably because he has the next statewide race in 2014. So, you know, he probably doesn't want to skip too close to that. I know that's 2 years away, but he's probably really not thinking about, well, I should skip Fancy Farm, because he's really pumped it up for Republicans to make it kind of a co-event, where it used to be a lot of Democrats were the only ones who would come down there.
And, of course, the presidential candidates, well, at least Mitt Romney, may be sending a surrogate?
Yeah, that's correct. Currently, it's between two guys, the Texas Agriculture Commissioner, which obviously does not ring a bell here in Kentucky, but I believe his name is Todd Staples. A bigger name that's under consideration is U.S. Senator Mike Johanns from Nebraska, and that would be kind of interesting. I think I would view that as more of a high-profile surrogate. When it comes to the Obama campaign, the Kentucky Democratic Party is trying to find a surrogate. They're still in conversations, according to Fancy Farm organizers. I don't know that there will be an Obama surrogate, especially since there's already a surrogate. You know, House Speaker Greg Stumbo will speak on behalf of Beshear. So the governor's not going to be there. The lieutenant governor's not going to be there. Apparently, most of the statewide Democrats, elected Democrats, Allison Lundgren Grimes, Jack Conway, have not confirmed whether they're going to be there, and we're only a week out, which is probably a bad sign. So the Democrats may just kind of leave the local Democrats and the local races to fend for themselves. I'm not sure we'll see a real Obama surrogate at Fancy Farm.
And, of course, it's a congressional year as well. Have you gotten a line on any of the congressional candidates that may attend?
Well, of course, you know, Congressman Ed Whitfield and his challenger will be at Fancy Farm, as they always are. But anybody outside of that, I think, would raise flags. If you saw, like, a Brett Guthrie, who's the congressman for the 2nd District, which is basically almost to Louisville, Bowling Green, and redistricting really pulled his district more east, I think that would be a surprise. I think people would have to ask questions about whether Guthrie has another office in mind, maybe governor in 2015. If we saw Ben Chandler, who's nowhere near Fancy Farm, you would have to think, okay, maybe Chandler is mulling another statewide run, maybe governor in 15, maybe challenging McConnell. Other than that, I think, you know, what you're going to see is you're going to see the congressman for the 1st District, Ed Whitfield, his challenger show up, and they're gonna be the highest profile outside of McConnell and Romney surrogate at the picnic this year.
We've got quite a few retiring lawmakers in our region on the House side, and most of them, the retiring ones anyway, are all Democrats. Representative Brent Houseman is not necessarily retiring, but just simply leaving the House of Representatives as a Republican after a short stint there. But are there enough state House seats contested to overturn the Democratic majority?
You know, that's a big question that I think reporters and those in and outside of Frankfort are asking themselves. The Democrats do hold a lead in the House, and I think it would take roughly 7 or 8 victories to produce a tie or overtake the House. And so what's going to happen is these Western Kentucky seats that you're talking about, Representative Mike Cherry, Representative Fred Nessler, Melvin Henley, if those seats go Republican, I think that means that on election night, the Republican Party will either be insanely close to taking the House of Representatives or will take the House of Representatives. They are contesting a lot of seats. Of course, they have to defend some of their own. But Democrats are taking this seriously. The KDP is throwing all its weight this year behind the State House Democrats. House Republicans are throwing fundraisers, it seems like, every weekend, every other night of the week. Senator Mitch McConnell is really throwing his financial efforts behind House Republicans. That's going to be the battle this year. That's what people are going to have to watch for. And I truly believe if Fred Nessler's seats goes Republican, if Mike Cherry's seats goes Republican, then Democrats are going to be a little worried on election night, because those will probably be some of the last districts to come in. They may be biting their nails. Whether they go Republican or not, I think is yet to be seen. House races usually develop in the last month of a campaign. But if they go Republican, you may be looking at Jeff Hoover, new Speaker of the House.
Yeah, it's interesting because Melvin Henley originally ran as a Republican in far western Kentucky and then switched his party while he was in office. But Mike Cherry and Fred Nessler were longtime Democrats serving in the House. Was there any message that maybe we didn't receive as to why these three lawmakers, all three Democrats, did retire at the same time, or is it a coincidence?
You know, I think it has a lot to do with coincidence. I mean, Fred Nessler took a job in the agriculture department with James Comer. Obviously, what that means is a better pension. Lawmakers usually don't pass that up. Mike Cherry's been in the legislature for a long, long time. I think he just got tired of Frankfort. The sessions have gotten more grueling, a lot more personal, and I think a lot of lawmakers just got tired of that. You know this probably better than anybody, Chad. You know, Western Kentucky has a lot of registered Democrats, but they're the guys who vote Republicans in federal races, and McConnell and other Republicans have really focused on that region to make sure they start voting Republican for local races and for state races. And so that's the battleground, and it hurts Democrats to have three senior members go. Go into your previous question as well. If those seats go Republican, and if it's not enough to take the House for Republicans, there are rumors that maybe some of the other Western Kentucky Democrats that are really conservative might flip, like Henley did, to Republican, and that Republicans can get control that way. So it's kind of almost double trouble for Democrats. If they lose the seats but hold on to other Democratic seats in the Western Kentucky region, those Democrats may flip to Republican, and they didn't help themselves out. The Democratic Party is in trouble either way.
Okay, apart from politics for candidates at Fancy Farm, are there any policy issues that might be front and center at the picnic?
You always see policy issues at the picnic between all the jokes and all the pranks campaigns do. One new one this year will be in the last couple of years, there's been a push for a statewide smoking ban, the Smoke Free Kentucky Coalition. And on Monday, they are going to basically kick off a road tour, start in Louisville and Lexington, kind of make their way down to Somerset, over the Bowling Green, and finally to the picnic on Saturday to drum up support, pick up supporters, and let people in those areas know that what they think Kentucky deserves, a smoke-free Kentucky, as they say. Gatewood Galbraith was always down there, whether he was running or not, really talking up medical marijuana and hemp issues and the issues that were important to his campaign. And I believe some of his supporters still plan to have a presence down there talking about those issues. Could be a few other issues. You just never know who decides to jump in the car on Saturday morning and make the trip down to the picnic.
Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Kenny Colston talking about Fancy Farm's annual political picnic, which is going on this upcoming weekend. Kenny, thanks for your time and stay cool.
All right, thank you.
A new report ranks Kentucky low on child well-being. After the break, we'll find out what the Commonwealth could do to improve its standing. Then the WKMS youth reporters bring us the latest from Murray's Playhouse in the Park. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. You're listening to Front Page Sunday. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. The Annie E. Casey Foundation released the Kids Count Data Book this week, which ranks states according to their efforts to promote child well-being. Kentucky ranked 35th in the nation this year, with education and health care the state's lowest contributing factors. Drew Adams speaks to the foundation's Associate Director of Policy Research and Data, Laura Speer, about the Commonwealth's ranking and how it could pull itself up by its bootstraps.
We've been doing the Kids Count Data Book for about 20 years here at the Foundation, and every year we use data that comes from the Federal Statistical Agencies, which involves basically the Census Bureau, the CDC, Vital Statistics, those types of places, and we take that data and rank the states on overall child well-being. We have to use data that comes from federal agencies because we want to make sure that all the data is collected comparably across all the states.
Among the 50 states, Kentucky ranked 35th overall, with New Hampshire in first and Mississippi in 50th. Do you find that there are geographic consistencies or regional similarities among the findings?
There are some. The states that tend to do the best on our rankings are generally in the Northeast, and the states also in the upper Midwest. States in the South, and that's really the Southwest as well as the Southeast, tend to do more poorly on our rankings. And Kentucky is on the high end, I'd say, of that Southeastern pattern. Most of the states in the South actually do score worse than Kentucky. But we definitely do have that regional sort of overtone to our rankings.
It seems that we've had a rise in what I would call scary stats. However, there's one marker in which it seems we've made some significant progress, and that is health. We're ranked 25th there as opposed to economic well-being and family and community welfare, which Kentucky comes in at 35th and 38th, respectively. That being said, are there other areas where Kentucky may have excelled?
Well, in education, the state's doing fairly well. The state's ranked 28th in education, so I would include sort of education and health among the areas where Kentucky is doing well and doing better over the last half decade, and that's in line with the national trend. At the national level, we saw education and health indicators for the most part improving across the country, and like in Kentucky, the economic well-being indicators all got worse at the national level, which is not too surprising given the economy and the recession that we've been in over the last 5 years. So I think the declines in both fourth graders who are not proficient in reading and the eighth grade students who are not proficient in math are both positive things. And as far as some of the biggest improvements, the drop in the child and teen death rate over the period that we looked at from 2005 to 2009 is pretty impressive. It went from 41 per 100,000 to 32 per 100,000.
You mentioned this just a moment ago, but of our 8th graders in the state, 69% are not proficient in math, and 64% of our 4th graders aren't proficient in reading. We match up fairly close to the national average, but that's quite astounding to know that we're that far behind the curve nationally.
The good news is that they're going in the right direction. That's been more of a focus on these two important outcomes for kids in education, the 4th grade reading and 8th grade math. But we're still, like you said, at the national level and in Kentucky, that 2 out of 3 fourth graders are not proficient in reading. And the reason why that indicator is so important is that up until the fourth grade, children are learning to read. And after the fourth grade, they need to use reading in order to do everything else, to learn how to do math, in order to learn how to do science, and really to succeed in life thereafter. The fact that only 2 out of 3 fourth graders at the national level are proficient in reading is shocking to most people. And I think it also says a little bit about how far behind the curve we are compared to other countries. I think that's what's most disturbing. We know the generation that's going to be entering the workforce over the next 20 years is going to have to compete globally like no other generation before them. And having that math proficiency level be as low as it is a bit scary in terms of what we hope to achieve going forward.
The other number that struck me as something I didn't really expect was the children in poverty nationally grew 3%, and we're a bit higher than that. We went from 22% to 26%. Do we attribute much of that to the fiscal crisis?
The child poverty rate is very closely connected with the unemployment rate in the country. So when the unemployment rate goes up, the child poverty rate goes up. So that's certainly what we're seeing here. And the reason why that matters beyond just bringing income into the household is that when you have full-time year-round work, you'll be able to access things like employer-sponsored health insurance for you and for your family. It's a lot higher. For these 4 out of 10 kids in Kentucky, they don't have access to those resources because they don't have a parent that's employed full-time year-round.
Drew Adams spoke with the Annie E. Casey Foundation's Associate Director of Policy, Research, and Data, Laura Speer. To find out more about Kentucky's standings as well as a link to the Kids Count report, visit WKMS.org. Every year, Murray's Playhouse in the Park invites children to a week-long summer theater camp, engaging them in the production of a full-length show. 90 kids signed up this year, and WKMS youth reporters Anna Kate Brown, Bryn Jones, and Wendy Waltrip bring us this behind-the-scenes scoop on the show, Disney's Cinderella Kids.
I'm Anna Kate Brown speaking with Holly Bloodworth, the director of the 2012 Playhouse in the Park Summer Camp and production of Cinderella. How many children do you have to deal with this summer in the camp?
Well, we have 90 children signed up. We have them divided into two casts. There's about 45 in each cast. And then we also have a lot of helpers. So really my job is kind of orchestrating it all, keeping everybody busy, and just kind of making sure it all runs smoothly.
Why did you choose Cinderella this year, and what can audiences expect to see?
We chose Cinderella this year because we really like the format of the Disney Kid productions. This show did have several different kinds of characters that we thought would be fun. We were a little afraid that we wouldn't get any boys because it was Cinderella. So we've really tried to bring in the medieval theme and do some things with castles and swords. We hope that what audiences will see is a delightful production that has magical possibilities with lots of mice that become horses and pumpkins that become carriages. And what they will see is a lot of children having a lot of fun on stage.
Thank you, Ms. Bloodworth. And this is Anna Kate Brown from the WKMS Youth Project.
A dream is a wish.
Jones, speaking with Lisa Cope, director of Murray's Playhouse in the Park. What kind of stuff do campers do here?
Of course, the focus is the show, but every day they get to do all kinds of other things that we try to tie it in with the theme of the show or the time period of the show or something like that, that they can actually learn some things outside of just the script and the music and the dancing, which obviously they're working on. This year, campers painted a big piece of the set, the castle. That helps them take ownership of that, and I think that's great.
Thank you so much, Lisa Co. I'm Bryn Jones for the WKMS Youth Project.
I'm Wendy Waltrip with both Cinderellas.
Katherine Herford.
Katie Eisen.
So what do you guys like about acting?
Well, I just love, you know, singing and dancing, so it's just really fun.
Well, I like kind of being a new person.
Will it be embarrassing dancing with the prince on stage?
Yes.
Well, maybe a little. I mean,
so now I'm talking to
Patrick Jones,
Jackson Bell,
who are both playing Prince Charming. What's harder, the singing, the dancing, the acting, or the memorizing lines?
Not really any of that. I can memorize all of that in just probably a few days.
Probably dancing with Cinderella.
So, will it be embarrassing dancing with Cinderella on stage in front of everybody?
Definitely.
No.
Thank you very much.
Playhouse in the Park's production of Disney's Cinderella Kids runs sold-out shows this weekend, but seats are still available for additional performances at 6 o'clock Monday and Tuesday. For tickets, call 270-759-1752 or visit playhouseinthepark.net. WKMS Youth Project volunteer Rusty Jones coordinated our reporters. Learn more about the Youth Radio Project and how your child can participate by emailing us at msu.wkms@murraystate.edu.
In the majority of rural Kentucky communities, people are still stigmatized for having HIV. Many are afraid to seek treatment or don't know about treatment options, and more than half can't afford to pay for medications. Kentucky is also home to metropolitan areas where HIV numbers are much higher and the need is more visible. The challenge for state health officials is addressing both the large scale and the small scale. Sika Jane is the Kentucky Department of Public Health HIV/AIDS branch manager. She works on the front lines of the state's HIV/AIDS policy, programs, and statistical research. Angela Hatton spoke with her and brings us their conversation.
I've talked to some clinicians out here in Western Kentucky, and they say that the issue they have is not enough education and outreach, and the biggest need they have is money to do that. So what's at stake for those people who are living with HIV/AIDS or at risk for it and don't know it?
That's a very complex issue, and it continues to be a challenge because most of the people who are at risk for HIV/AIDS are also the same people who are at risk for a lot of other things. And most of the time, it is because of those things that they are vulnerable to HIV. They may not have access to medical treatment. They also may have other environmental barriers, for example, stigma and discrimination that would stop them from accessing HIV testing early. Or it might be that in their community, the distances in transportation would not allow them to get to a place that's close enough to where they can get diagnosed early. For those people, if you're diagnosed very late, one of the things that CDC shows is that about 50 to 75% of new cases are because of individuals who are unaware of their HIV status and who then unknowingly transmit to others. So therefore, we really do target people who don't know their status. We look at our data and say, who is it that don't know their status? When we looked at it, we saw two groups of people. There were people in the urban areas where the burden of the disease is, but we saw that if you go, for example, into eastern Kentucky, whereas the number of cases are small, you see that some counties have a very high proportion of their cases that are actually undiagnosed. And the way we know who is undiagnosed, looking at who is being tested so late that by the time they are diagnosed, within a calendar month or two, they're being diagnosed with AIDS. So meaning the disease has progressed for up to 10 years or more before you actually start getting sick and the disease progresses to AIDS.
And one of the reasons that that's happening is that HIV still in some communities is carrying a stigma, that there's an assumption made about an HIV-positive person's sexual habits. And I've heard this case where people have gone from Paducah to Bowling Green to seek treatment or vice versa because they don't want people in their home community to know that they are HIV-positive. So how do we overcome prejudices like that?
That perception and that stigma is what is really killing us, because if HIV infected, or even if I just want to know my status, I'm scared, especially in a small rural area where I know if I go into the local health department, I might see someone I know, whether because they work there or they're sitting close to me. I don't want to go in there. Or if there's an HIV clinic or an HIV doctor, I don't want even anybody to see me go in there, because somebody else will go and say, I saw so-and-so walking into the HIV clinic, or I saw so-and-so, I'm asking for an HIV test. And a lot of it is fear. People are fearful, and even in this day and age, people think that you can get HIV by just sitting next to someone who is HIV infected, by drinking after someone who's HIV infected. And that is absolutely not true. HIV is not obtained in that way, as I mentioned. So I think a lot of education is what is needed, media campaigns. Unfortunately, as our budgets are being cut more and more, we have to focus on high-impact efforts such as testing. We also try to normalize. CDC just released an effort where testing is being done in local pharmacies. If you can walk into your local pharmacy and get HIV testing, then I wouldn't be fearful of, oh, someone saw me going into the HIV clinic. Instead, someone saw me go into my local pharmacy. I could be doing anything there, so it affords me more confidentiality.
So overall, how would you rank Kentucky's HIV prevention and treatment programs and initiatives compared to the rest of the nation if you had to give yourself a report card?
It's very hard to do overall. I think there are some areas that we do very well. With the little amount of money, the little amount of money that we get to cover 120 counties, and oftentimes when I go to national meetings, I tell people, when you look at the South, including Kentucky, and Kentucky has very southern characteristics, you can't compare dollar for dollar, for example, a state like Kentucky against your New York. Your New York might have a larger number of cases, but the issues around every single case, the cost of service, the severity of need is much greater oftentimes because, for example, if you take somebody in eastern Kentucky versus someone in New York City, just look at their location. How many miles do they have to go before they get education around HIV testing? How many miles do they have to go before they get a clinic? There's no even public transportation. There might be stigma and discrimination. There might be higher poverty rates. And all these things affect somebody's vulnerability to HIV and other diseases. So I always say the severity of need is much greater here. So for every win that we have, it takes much more effort for us to get that win than, say, in another state that has much more money, much more variety of services. So for the little money that we have, we really have done a good job.
Siga Jain, HIV/AIDS branch manager, thank you for speaking with me.
You're more than welcome, Angela.
There are a handful of people in our region who remember when the Olympics were last in London. Their stories and a look at what snakes in Western Kentucky are really like when Front Page Sunday returns.
This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Earlier this month, we reported on the rise in the number of snake bites in Kentucky, a rise officials say is due in part to drought conditions throughout the state. It turns out that snakes, like people, can head for water when it gets dry. When they run into each other, it can be unfortunate. Of course, this doesn't mean all or even most snakes are bad or even dangerous. But if you spot a snake on the trail or in the garden, how do you tell the difference between one that's venomous and one that's not? And if it is, what do you do? For some answers and to find out more about these slithering fellow residents of our region, I headed out to Murray State University's Hancock Biological Station to speak with Chris Howie. He's a fourth-year doctoral student in herpetology, the study of amphibians and reptiles at Ohio University. He explains that snakes, far from being something to fear, are actually very helpful and can even make good pets.
How common are snakes in Western Kentucky?
It depends on the actual species that we're talking about. A lot of the different species that are non-venomous are very common, like the black racer, for example. But it also is dependent upon how we see them. And if it's something like a black racer, if you come across it, it's going to run away from you. And so it appears to be very common because we see them a lot. Timber rattlesnakes, I don't know if we really know the exact population sizes of them. So these venomous snakes that we have out here, they might be very common, and more than likely they probably are. But most of the time, they're going to be sitting put and not moving and not letting you know they're there. And more than likely, you're going to walk right by them and never even know it. And I've seen this many a times where people just are walking and step right next to it and just keep on walking and the snake never moves. Most of the times, too, these snakes are never going to bite you when you're walking right by them and you don't notice them. A lot of times you might even step on it and it might not bite you. Most bites are going to be when you're trying to pick it up or you're trying to handle it or you're trying to kill it. So they're pretty common. But it's relative. It's relative to the behavior of the animal and how often we see the animal. And more than likely, they were always common, but you just never saw them.
Hypothetically, if I go out into the backyard and I'm going to water my garden and I reach over to my garden hose and I see part of it moving and immediately my brain goes, snake, is there a good rule of thumb for determining whether or not that snake is venomous or non-venomous?
There's a few characteristics you can look at. And unfortunately, the two most common snakes that we have that might be found in your garden are fairly different from one another. If you first think snake, the next thing to do is step back. And then you have time to take a good look at the animal and see if it's venomous or not. They always say these snakes have a triangular head. And so the back of the head is much broader than a non-venomous snake. And this is because they have those venom glands back there. And they're going to have elliptical pupils. Now, if you can see the pupils of the snake, you might be too close. And more than likely, you might not see the head at all of the snake. Like you said, you might just see something moving, and you might say, snake, and quickly step back.
I've heard this, and you probably heard it yourself, that the only good snake is a dead snake.
Oh, yeah.
But I kind of get the feeling you disagree with that.
Oh, yeah. Snakes are actually great for the ecosystem. And when we remember about wildlife and managing for wildlife, everything has its place. And we take certain things out of that ecosystem, and you're going to get cascading events. And one of those examples might be if we took out things like a lot of our snakes, we're going to get a lot more rodents. And, you know, I would rather have more snakes that are typically harmless to us and are going to mind their own than rodents that are going to be spreading diseases. And on top of that, the majority of snake bites that happen in the U.S. are people trying to mess with the snakes, especially trying to kill the snakes. So your best bet if you're not looking to get bit is to not mess with it.
So if I come out to the backyard and I find a snake, then what do I do? I mean, I don't necessarily want this thing in my backyard, sure. So what should I do next?
You can contact your fish and game representative. And if you go online to the Kentucky Fish and Game website, they have a list of different districts, and we can find our district and find the officers for this district, and they will come out and they will remove it for you.
What if I am trying to remove the snake, and or I step on the snake, and this is one of those slim chances where it decides to bite me, mm-hmm. and I notice that it is venomous? What do I do then? We've heard all sorts of things, like a tourniquet above the bite, cutting an X over the bite and sucking the poison out.
So if you go to Walmart, they actually still sell these bite kits. They're little yellow kits, and they have a little suction thing in there that'll help you suck out some of the venom. There's a little scalpel to make that incision. There's a little rope that you can make a tourniquet. And all of these things are wrong. You never want to do these. If you do something like sucking out the venom, you're more than likely not going to get a significant amount of that venom that was put into you. You might get a little bit out, so okay. But if you make something like an incision, you're going to increase blood flow. And that's not going to increase the blood flow of the venom coming out. It's going to increase the blood flow and the venom going more in. If you use a tourniquet, you're localizing the venom. And that means you're going to have a much more severe reaction at that spot. So for example, let's say you got bit on the hand and you made a tourniquet at the base of your hand, there's a good chance that you might have severe enough damage where you're going to lose your hand. More than likely, what you should do in these instances is try to remain calm. It's more than likely going to hurt. It's like a very, very bad bee sting. Try to keep yourself together and get to the hospital. Best bet is to not drive yourself to the hospital, but have a friend or family member or neighbor drive you to the hospital. And at that point, they're not even going to give you antivenin. This is basically something that counteracts the venom. They're going to watch your symptoms, see how they progress, and if things do get severe, then they will take their chances in giving you that antivenin.
Having talked to people, as I presume you have, about snakes and things of that nature, I'm sure at some point you've probably come to some, at least anecdotal, conclusion as to why, in the main, people do not like snakes.
I think the biggest reason is because they are sneaky. They do hide, and you see them kind of at the last minute. Things that we don't know a lot about scare us. And this is why when you learn a lot about them, that fear goes away. And you learn that they're actually not that bad. I think most people fear snakes just because of the sole fact we don't know a lot about them. We know they're out there, and we know there's some that can hurt us, but it's kind of like that monster in the dark to us.
Well, and let's face it, they're not exactly cuddly, are they?
I don't know. Some of them can be cuddly. I remember my mother said I was allowed to bring my pet snake home if I taped cotton balls to it. Because it made it fuzzy. But they're not. They do have personalities to them. And we radio track a bunch of snakes out in LBL. And after radio tracking these individual snakes throughout the course of the summer, you start to learn they do have these different personalities. You have some that quickly run away from you, and they're really skittish. You have others that will quickly go up in a tree and then watch every move you do because they're curious. And you do have some that will hold their ground, and they think they're big, bad, and tough. So they have personalities. They're not cuddly personalities, maybe, but I think it's relative. You get a ball python, though, and you get a hognose snake, and it will curl up in your lap as a pet. It might be seeking warmth from you, but I think sometimes that's what cats are doing as well. Companionship, maybe not. But, yeah, they're good pets, and they're good animals, and they have good personalities sometimes. What a lot of the data that scientists are collecting is showing us is that things like timber rattlesnakes throughout a large majority of their range are actually becoming very less common. And their populations are actually being decimated, especially in places like much further south from here, where they have things like rattlesnake roundups. And these are times you can go out there and you can round up as many rattlesnakes as you can. You bring them back to this fairground-like atmosphere where they basically have exhibits, and they allow you to sit there and mess with them and finally kill them in the end. Those that aren't killed are shipped off to pharmaceutical companies, and a lot of pharmaceutical companies will pay for rattlesnakes as well because of the venom has qualities that relieve pain, believe it or not. And so a lot of these populations are either being decimated in large numbers by things like these rattlesnake roundups or being collected for medical purposes or other purposes. Populations are literally being wiped out. And so where we are getting more bites being reported, which might just be because we have so many more people nowadays, it's kind of contradictory to what's going on with the rattlesnake populations themselves.
Chris Howey is a doctoral student at Ohio University. He's studying herpetology, that's amphibians and reptiles, at Murray State's Hancock Biological Station on Kentucky Lake. For more information about the snakes that live in Kentucky and in the Four Rivers region, we have a link to the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife's snake book at WKMS.org. She said,
like I wanna be loved by you.
The 2012 Summer Olympic Games are underway in London, and millions around the world are expected to tune in over the next few weeks to watch the competition. This is the third time Great Britain has hosted the Games. The last was in 1948, in the wake of World War II. As Angela Hatton reports, at least two former British residents in our region say the games then weren't the spectacle they are today.
In the true spirit of sportsmanship, for the honor of our country, and for the glory of sport.
That's Donald Finlay, British athletic team captain, reading the Olympic Oath on July 29, 1948, at the start of the Summer Games. History remembers the Olympics that year as an important event because it was the first time the Games had been held following a 12-year hiatus brought about by World War II. The war in Europe had concluded just 3 years before, and London still showed the scars of bombings. Murray State history professor Bill Mulligan.
And I think 48 symbol, you know, in many ways, let's get back to normal. We'll gather together and celebrate, you know, sport, celebrate this Olympic experience, and try to put the world, which has become all in turmoil for so long, you know, put that behind us and try to move forward.
One might imagine that the whole nation gathered together around their radio sets on the day of the opening ceremonies, ready to cheer on the athletes. Right?
No, not really.
Terry Carlton lives in Paducah, but in 1948, he was a 15-year-old schoolboy. Carlton says in his hometown of Leeds, England, the family radio only picked up local sports.
Mum and Dad, you never heard them talk about, oh, well, there's this big thing going on down in London. It's called the Olympics. We didn't know about that.
What about Patricia Perkins of Murray? In 1948, Perkins had just moved to Weston-super-Mare, an English seaside resort. Does she remember the Olympics?
No, I don't. No, I guess I was too busy doing other things.
What gives? Shouldn't a big event like the Olympics be a major part of a young person's memory? Mulligan says you have to remember what had just happened a few years before. For one thing, World War II had a much bigger effect on Great Britain than it did on the United States.
You know, in 1948, if you're a young person, the Olympics far away in London might not register very much as opposed to trying to get back into normal routine, your city being rebuilt, trying to reestablish the normal patterns of your lives.
Mulligan also notes that the Olympics weren't an overnight success.
But it really has been an evolutionary thing, and they've become increasingly popular both as media coverage has expanded and as the ability to travel to the sites has become easier.
But that doesn't mean the Brits didn't care about sport. Carlton says sport has always been an important part of British culture. In 1947, he held the country's third highest record for high jump. That same year, he remembers participating in a local games competition.
We did the 4x160 yards relay, and we won it with flying colors. And I was going that fast at the last lap. I think I went another half a lap before I could stop. But that's what sports were about in those days.
Carlton says over the years he's become an Olympics watcher. He particularly enjoys gymnastics. And he has a strong opinion about the games returning to his home country after 64 years.
Well, the only thing I can say is it's about time.
Carlton says few countries can compare with Great Britain's spirit of sportsmanship. For WKMS News, I'm Angela Hatton.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Heidi Couch, Angela Hatton, Casey Northcutt, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Mark Graff provides website assistance.
If you have comments or questions about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say on our Facebook page, and there's a link to that at our website, wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Thanks for listening.